Well, that's the late, great, I think he's late. I'm not sure. He may still be alive. Floyd Kramer, one of the greatest. I love his piano work, and that is "Have I Told You Lately That I Love You?" That's for the she-wolves out there. This is Freya's Day. Welcome to Freya's Day here in the bunker. Terrible Tommy on the 25th of July. Yeah, 2014. Got 5 days or so. I think it's 5 days. Maybe 6 days to get it done in July. So get out there and get it done. Or you're going to have to wait for August. Yeah. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your massive donations for the radio show and our other projects. And so I can buy me a big yacht and go down on the Mississippi to the gambling boat. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, it's a overcast here in the Midwest today. It's cool, but it's nice. This cool weather, sort of like an Indian summer, is pretty nice, you know. Instead of having that big, real hot stuff, man, I'll tell you. Guess what? Over 16 million Americans, or U.S. citizens, are working for less than $7.50 an hour. $7.50 an hour. Every time I talk to somebody at a fast food restaurant, or if I rarely, once in a while, get into Walmart, I'll always tell the greeters and so forth, and people wait on me, strike. You need more money. Do you realize how much this corporation made last year, and you're barely surviving? Wow. So I put out my propaganda. Well, the other day we were talking about words and the meaning of words and subhumans, and my little 99-cent dictionary didn't have it in there. So now I got my big dictionary out here, and it is in there. It's in there, yeah. It says below the human race or type, less than or not quite human, almost human. Well, I don't know. I guess you could say that about Obama, but I don't know where I would go that far. I think he's a weak, wishy-washy guy. He's probably a homosexual, according to Larry Sinclair up there in Chicago. I don't know. He never played with my baby. But anyhow, he's half white, so you can't call him subhuman. Come on. Okay. You may not like him. And you may not like a lot of things he does. But I'll tell you one thing. There's a hell of a lot of things the Republicans are doing that I think are even worse. So for now on, I'm going to keep my big old dictionary. I got one that's about 6 or 8 inches thick. And then I got one around here. I think I still got it around here. It's about a foot and a half thick. Boy, I'll tell you, it takes half a day to find something. Well, here's a news item that She-Wolf Southern California sent me. Scientists on Thursday released the results of a first-of-its-kind study. You'd have thought they were should have been studying this a long time ago. That finds that 7 states of the drought-stricken Colorado River Basin are depleting groundwater reserves at a rapid rate. Well, hell, I knew that for years. We knew the Colorado River was shrinking down and pollution all in the Colorado River and everything. By the time the Colorado River gets down to Mexico, it's just a little trickle. That threatens the future of a river. Jeez, at this late date, they're finally figuring this out when any farmer out there in the West could have told you. Anyhow, that supplies water to 40 million people and irrigates 4 million acres of farmland. See, I told you Mother Nature would come to our defense. All these millions of Mexicans and everything and all these blacks and everything that have moved into the West and Southwest, well, they're going to have to figure a way of getting water. Oh, yeah, it's going to be hard on white Aryans, too, but white Aryans should have the intelligence and the brain power to figure out how to sidestep it and move or do something. Scientists at the University of California, Irvine, and NASA analyzed data from a satellite that measures underground water reserves to calculate that the Colorado River Basin has lost 65 cubic kilometers, that's 17.3 trillion gallons of water between December 2004 and November 2013. That represents twice the capacity of the United States' largest reservoir, Lake Mead in Nevada. Most worrying, 75% of the loss came from underground water supplies. Well, what about fracking? They're pumping millions of gallons of water in fracking and polluting it and everything else. You got millions of Mexicans, mestizos, Central Americans, ragheads, everybody coming in. They're all drinking water, baby. I mean, I know I and a lot of other people were telling you this 30 years ago. 30 years ago when the wheat farmers were telling me in Colorado that their wells were had to go down farther and farther and farther, thousands of feet deep, to get enough water to irrigate their wheat. So anyhow, Mother Nature's coming to the rescue. Now, Mother Nature, she doesn't do, when she teaches us, she does not do it with kid gloves. She kicks our ass. And if it takes the loss of water to drive out all these Untermenschen in the West, that's fine too. And some people will live to learn, learn to live in a natural way and survive. But the ones who want it easy, they're going to go someplace else. So the trouble is, a whole lot of that riffraff are going to be putting a mattress on mattresses on top of their car and headed back east. But back east has water problems too, and that's another story. Yeah. But just keep on fracking. That'll help the water supply. Oh, Jesus. Well, the Simon Wiesenthal Center is upset. Associate Dean Rabbi Abraham Cooper on Thursday slammed the Huffington Post. Now, that's amazing that the Huffington Post could make the Jews unhappy. Well, it made that bunch of Jews unhappy. Reporter Sophie Jones, its Middle East correspondent, for the sensationalist headline, quote, "They just wanted to kill as many people as possible," unquote. Cooper said the headline accusing Israel of targeting civilians in its current war against Hamas in Gaza, and Jones' reporting takes the art of lying and self-delusion to new depths. Huffington Post article quoted Israel Defense Forces Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, the IDF's official spokesman, described Israel's policy and procedure to warn civilians before striking Gaza targets. But then accusing Israel of targeting civilians as collective punishment. Well, you got to realize what? There's 2 million, over 2 million people crammed into a little rinky-dink Gaza Strip. So what if they warn you? Where are you going to go? They're moving from one block to another. They get hit on one block. They go to another block. That is the biggest bunch of BS that anybody could put out, because it'd be like hunting rabbits with maybe 100-foot wired in cage, and put 500 rabbits in there, and then say, "Well, if they'll just move out of the way, we won't hit any of them." But any way you shoot, you're gonna hit one. So that's the, you know, I like it the way, you know, also all the money that the Christian churches are putting into this thing, the money that they're putting in, all the taxpayers supporting Israel's war machine, giving them the latest arms and everything else. I'm going to put an attachment in with this show about a recent conference where all these Christian Zionists got together, that rogue progressive put it together. But what I'm going to do on this stuff from now on, I'm not going to include much of it in the show. I'll send a separate attachment for it, and then you can listen to it when you want. Anyhow, this whole thing over there is just, of course they want to wipe out the Palestinians. They want the final solution for the Palestinians. If they could just get rid of these 2 million Palestinians, life would be so sweet there in Israel. Yeah. And that's what most of them want. Most of them want. Yep. Let's see here. Where's my button? There's my button. I'll tell you one thing. When you get Huffington Post to say something that pisses off the Jews, you're really getting something going. Because the Huffington Post always, most of the time, stands up for the Jews 100%. They won't even let me make a comment into the Huffington Post comment line. You know, I put them all over the place and almost every place accepts my comment. But Huffington Post says, "You're banned, baby. You're a banned boy." Well, I suppose you know another U.S. citizen Jew got his ass blown off over there in Israel. It's interesting that they can't seem to get enough Israelis willing to serve in the IDF. They had to now make a law to recruit the ultra-Orthodox for draft them in, and they're still not getting enough, so they got all these deluded Jews from the United States coming over there. Like I said the other day, over 2,000 of them. And now here's this guy who's Steinberg. He lived up in around San Francisco, as I recall, going over there and getting his ass blown off for nothing. So anyhow, that's okay. Just keep sending them over there. Now, they had another eulogy for this other Jew. That's his Sergeant Nissam Sean Carmelli, 21. The Jewish community of a South Texas beach town was in mourning on Sunday after it was informed that one of its sons was among the Israeli troops that fell in a bloody Gaza battle on Saturday night as he shot little kids and teenagers and so forth, but he got it too. Sergeant Nissan Sean Carmelli, 21, had moved to Rananana from South Padre Island, population 2,800, Jewish population 75, where his family moved from Israel over 20 years ago. His parents are Elan and Dalia Carmelli. The whole community feels like they lost their own son, Rabbi Yonatan, the family's rabbi, told the Allgemeiner on Sunday. That's a Jewish magazine. The family's completely devastated, Rabbi Asher Heck, another rabbi friend, said. Well, there you go. I don't think there's too many of those 2,800 people who are out there in the streets beating their chest over this. When people go to foreign countries, no matter whether they're a Jew or what, to help an occupation, when they get it, they get what they deserve, really. I mean, when you try to rein in people in another country and occupy them, you deserve to be shot. Because I know if I was in another country and you brought your sorry ass over there and pushed me around, I'd shoot you between the eyes, too. Well, here's the latest in a fight between two black ladies. One is a lighter black and the other was a black. What are you doing? Oh, no. Oh, no, yelled a woman as she begged for her life after having her head cut off by a neighbor. Wait a minute. Oh, before having her head cut off by a neighbor. Leah Chavez, 42, allegedly murdered Shanelle Toya Thompson Brown, 27, by chopping off the woman's head with what authorities described as a sharp instrument. The two New York women had gotten into an argument over unpaid rent, which apparently led to the killing. Brown, a mother of four, reportedly begged for her life before being fatally wounded by Chavez and dismembered. Witnesses said they heard horrific screams from Brown after the woman entered Chavez's apartment. First witnesses recall Brown screaming, Oh no, I'm sorry, and then Chavez yelling at the woman to shut up. I'm going to cut your head off. Authorities found the Guyana immigrants, invaders, authorities found the Guyana invaders, dismembered torso in a wooded area in Long Island on July 9th. The dead woman's arms are found about 25 miles away, and her head was discovered at another location. According to prosecutors, Chavez may have been pretending to be the landlord after the death of the landlord last year. She reportedly collected rent from tenants, even though they did not have hot water and many were without electricity. Brown is believed was fed up with the scam and refused to pay rent until the issues were resolved. There you go. That's the kind of people you're letting into the country. These invaders just looking for a new life, looking for a job and a new life to live the American dream by cutting their neighbor's head off if they give them shit. So anyhow, there you go. A Guyanan. Probably used a machete. That's the weapon of choice. You know, I hear a lot of these liberal, progressive radio shows. You never hear them talking about this kind of stuff. No. They're more interested in whether two cops down in Podunk, Florida might have had gone to a KKK meeting. I went into my local Fish Wrap newspaper yesterday and told them they wasted a half a page on these two guys and cops in Florida who might have KKK connections. I said, don't we have some news around this town? Don't we have a hell of a lot more problems and things to talk about than that? I said, if you want that kind of publicity, I can give it to you. I can get some people from Central Casting and put on robes on them, and they can go down here in the city park. Then you can have a worldwide story right here in Warsaw. They said, oh, no, please. Hey, don't forget, we've got a case of these resist.com T-shirts. Black with white letters, and then we've got the non-equal sign on them. They're nice looking shirts. Got a whole case of them here. We've got several extra large too. So send us a $10 donation, we'll send you a T-shirt. I've got some others over here in a box too. I'm gonna have to look them up. We haven't had too many orders on T-shirts, so. But this was a good one. You can wear this one any place. Resist.com and. They can write it down and go home and then get mad and run back down and try to find it, but you'll be gone. If Tommy can wear it out in public, anybody can. Well, let's take a little trip back in history here for just a few minutes on the founding and what went on in bringing the Black Panther together, the Black Panthers in Los Angeles, which I'm aware quite a bit of because I was becoming active at the time. Let's hear what this is. Ronald Elder, he was one of the first people in the Black Panthers.
Carter, and how was the Los Angeles Black Panther Party founded?
Bunchy Carter, well, the first thing I'm going to have to say, he was a very dynamic human being, and he had a love for his people that was unbinding because he wanted to see the situation and the community really change. He was, as a young man, he was as well as myself, but we was on different parts of the city. We was part of social groups. Some people call them gangs. I ain't got nothing against the word gang. I think we all need to gang up. You know, the system is ganged up against us, and we need to gang up if we want to have any kind of life within our community. So I believe in us coming together socially, dealing with things. But this was in the streets. And it was dealing with young black men organizing themselves into groups. And Bunchy was on the east side, and I lived on the west side, but he was one that organized a group called the Slauson Renegades. He was a Slauson. And his organizing abilities exceeded anybody else because the group that he had became the major and the only, really, group in Los Angeles at one period. It was the only time in the history of Los Angeles where all of us was from one group. There wasn't no Crips or no Bloods. It wasn't none of that. It was just Slauson. And so, as far as us coming together as a group, we had all band together as one. I mean, Bunchy had band the younger people as one. They, it was like just a group, just a little bit younger than me. And they was all united as in one group. And Bunchy was the leader. So nobody ever did that. Nobody else did anything like that.
What years are we talking?
64, 63. Yeah. That's when they were starting to rise up a lot, you know, like in 60, I guess you could say 63, 64. You know, it really, it wasn't no, our people really wasn't engaging in that. A lot of us that got older, you know, was having our children and families and things, so we wasn't really in the streets as much. It was in years before 65. So like when 65 came and that thing happened, it was like all of the different groups kind of band together. It wasn't whether you was from Boot Hill or you was from Vineyard or you was from the Gladiators or the Businessmen or the Farmers or the Slawsons. It was all about our community having some life. So young people was looking at things in a different light. They weren't looking at things as far as like just for themselves. The community was doing good. Everybody else was doing good. So for a period there, it was the community was united and moving in one direction, and that was that our situation had to change, and it had to change now. So that was a time I changed. A lot of people changed how we looked at things.
So what made you guys open the doors? Where was the first office, and what led to the actions that opened the doors? And when did you and your brother come in?
Well, me and my brother, we got involved at the end of 67, after Huey got arrested. And Bunchy Carter was in touch with the Black Panther Party previous to that, and they was talking about forming a chapter. This is prior to opening up that Black Panther was here. It was just calling different people saying, hey, we're going to start a Black Panther Party in Los Angeles, come to this meeting. And me and my brother went, and we met Bunchy, and we made a commitment at that time that we was going to struggle for the liberation of our people. Well, you can call it the Mau-Mau Oath. So we had committed ourselves to a struggle for our people from now on, if it kill us or whatever happened. So from that point on, I got involved. I was at our first offices. We just had buttons and things, and then they were fitting to start the whole Free Huey campaign was fitting to be launched. And so in the next year, in February, we opened up, officially opened up the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles. And our office at that time was at the Black Congress. Then we moved to from the Black Congress. We got our own office a couple of months later in 68, first part of 68, January, February. No, after February, then he was at the Black Congress, then we moved to our office, and it was still in the spring of 68, and the 41st and Central, where they had later on, and maybe about 2 years later, they had the shootout in Los Angeles. That was our headquarters on 41st and Central, which I'll probably talk about later, the shootout with the Los Angeles police for over 4 hours, where they tried to raid and kill Black Panthers. I'm getting ahead of myself. So our first office was on 41st and Central. But the plan that Bunchy had in place was that we was going to have, because of the size of Los Angeles, we was going to have more than one office. And by it being, Bunchy being in charge of Southern California, which extended from Bakersfield on down to San Diego, to the Mexican border, offices had to also be established in other regions where there was black communities, and because our plight is the same. The conditions that we all was experiencing was the same. The capitalism, the racism, the exploitation. It wasn't just confined to Los Angeles. It's an international phenomenon. It's not just America. So all over America, in New York, Detroit, in the South, everywhere, we was all being exploited, and our conditions need to change. And in order for them to change, the whole system has to be rearranged. And so we participated in the politics to change that. So we opened up offices, a few more offices in South Central Los Angeles, also in San Diego, Santa Ana. We have people in Pomona, Riverside, Bakersfield, Santa Barbara, Venice, Long Beach, Compton. So we had offices in several cities. And
where was Central here?
Well, there's a little bit of an interview with one of the early members of the Black Panther Party, Ronald Elder Freeman. Now, the job of the right wing at the time of the Watts riots, and they came together real quick, but the right wing really had advance notice of the riot. And I've told you this story before, that the Minutemen met with the contingency of the blacks, probably Black Panthers at the time, in a warehouse down in Watts, California. And they had a talk over, and the blacks said, this place is going to go up. They said, what are you talking about? Well, the workers put all their money in the banks down here, and then they take the money and loan it out to the rich Jews up in Beverly Hills and stuff like that. And so they told the Minutemen that the riot was going to start pretty soon. They had blacks working in the neighborhoods, handing out literature, getting them ready, weeks before the riot started. So the gasoline was already poured all over the ground and just waiting for a match to drop. But the right wing back then was racist. The right wing was not full of all these conservative, so-called conservative right-wingers. Actually, they would have been looked at as liberals back then in the 60s. So when you say right-winger now and you say right-winger back then, there's two different situations. But the right-wing back then, Minutemen and so forth, which were the Minutemen were not overtly racist, even though it didn't work out that way. Robert Depew always said he was not a racist, but anyhow, their job, and other right wing and the Klan and so forth, of which I knew the leadership of the Klan at the time, and their job was to contain this riot and revolution. And the way they did that was that they armed themselves to the teeth, and usually four guys in a car armed to the teeth, and they were just circling that Watts area, waiting for blacks that were going to break out of there, and if they started burning and doing whatever they're going to do to white neighborhoods. So it was sort of a situation like that. They really didn't care if the blacks went up to Beverly Hills and raised hell, but they didn't really want them getting out into the white working class community. And so that was the job of right-wing groups at the time, was to contain this situation. So anyhow, you can listen to more of this kind of stuff. If it's a little bit boring, but there's a lot of information. And this came from Block Report Radio, which is it's a black radio program set up. And it's, I guess it's Block Radio, blockreportradio.com. And, but you got to listen to people on the other side if you want to get a lot of information, especially the history of the struggle on both sides or all sides. You see, you got the black side, you got the white side, and you got the system side. So there's at least three sides in the struggle. Sometimes the white side and the black side agree, and we've agreed on a lot of things over the years. and both sides generally end up not agreeing with the system. Maybe for different reasons, but they did. As I told you before on another show, my brother-in-law was a fireman down there going into the Watts Riot Zone and trying to put out fires, but they were taking on so much fire. They were shooting at them like mad, so they couldn't put out the fires, and they had to back their firefighting equipment out of there, and he was lucky he didn't get his ass shot off. They were looting like mad in the Watts area, and I remember I was working at Douglas Aircraft at that time, and I've told this story before too, that blacks would show up at work at Douglas Aircraft with trunks full of TVs and everything else that they'd looted, and they were selling them for, 20 cents on the dollar, so you could buy a brand new color TV for almost nothing because they were looting them all over the place. And later in the 70s, these black groups, and I forget the name of this group, it's right on the tip of my tongue, it shot it out with the police in L.A. They had a snitch, but by that time they were mixing the races. A lot of these black gangs had white guys and white women in them, like I forget her name. She was kidnapped and allegedly brainwashed, and they had her go in with them with a machine gun into a bank to rob it, and so they finally. They killed most of them, but the cops got her, and it went to court, and she was found innocent because they said she was doing this under pressure from these other gang members. SLA, they were called. I forget what that stood for. SLA. They surrounded her house down in South Central, and actually did like they did with Robert Matthews, and also with my memory. Now that was Gordon Call, and the cops and the feds have a habit of burning people out. They say they're putting up flares and torches so they can illuminate the area. So they shoot these flares up onto the roofs of wherever the person they're after is in and literally burn them to death like they did Robert Matthews, Gordon Call, and they did it on the left and the right with the blacks and the whites, like with the SLA. I think there was about 8 of them burnt to death in that situation. Sort of like the black move people in Philadelphia, that the mayor dropped a bomb on the apartment complex and burned down a whole bunch of townhouses or apartment buildings that were primarily blacks living in them that had nothing to do with this group move, but they burnt the whole thing. This is a favorite thing with the feds and even local police, is to burn you out. I know with the Bob Matthews situation, that not too long after Bob was murdered, things calmed down a little bit. I went up to the island where, Whidbey Island, where he was murdered, and we had to go in there by night to take pictures of the burned down building where he was at. We couldn't do it in the daytime, so we had to sneak in there at night and take some video by the light of our car headlights. I've got that video footage somewhere. But there was virtually nothing left of the house. It was just burnt embers and small pieces of wood. They burn it to the ground. Don't forget Waco. They did what they did at Waco. So in any kind of a situation, if they come after you, you better figure some way of keeping the keeping enough water, fire retardant around to keep the fires out. Maybe you need to have a totally concrete or stone building with a stone roof. Of course, in the case of Gordon Call and Bob Matthews, people like that. They could have waited them out. They didn't have to kill them. But they wanted to kill them. They were really into the killing mood. You know, they had Bob Matthews surrounded by about 500 agents, including the military. But you see, in all these kind of cases, you can wait a person out till he no water, no food. And after, you know, a week or so, they're going to have to come out of there. But they don't want to do that. No. Well, 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 Mr. Obama, the most transparent administration ever. Right, you're kidding. Fighting to keep White House racism scandal emails secret. Did you know about this? Yeah, Breitbart's argument is simple and straightforward, regardless of what else is in Sherrod's speech. The first video released on BigGovernment.com featured Sherrod telling a tale of racism that is received by the NAACP audience with laughter and cheers. They weren't cheering redemption, they were cheering discrimination. Upon hearing the cheers, Sherrod fails to offer any immediate clarification and even smiles right along with them. Sherrod was fired and then unfired. A lawsuit followed, and now back to the present. The Obama administration is fighting to keep secret hundreds of pages of emails detailing White House involvement in the 2010 firing and the attempted rehiring of Agricultural Department employee Shirley Sherrod after the late conservative blogger Andrew Breitbart published a blog post and video clips suggesting that Sherrod was a racist. I guess she'd have to be a black racist, I guess. Court's filings are normally public, but the Justice Department said the emails from the account of 9 White House staffers and additional number of Agricultural Department officials should be kept under wraps, in part because the public already has enough information through official statements about Sherrod's forced resignation and ensuing events. In July 13th motion, the Justice Department lawyers also invoked a deference to presidential confidentiality as a basis for keeping the contents of the emails secret. The Office of the President occupies a unique position in the constitutional scheme, and the public interest requires that a co-equal branch of government afford presidential confidentiality the greatest protection consistent with the fair administration of justice, unquote. Yeah, right. How very Nixonian of Obama. So what could be those emails? Obviously that Obama doesn't want the public to see and what could be so confidential about them. But if the DOJ doesn't get their way, some more hard drives will be crashing. Well, that's interesting. So we don't know what's in the emails, but there were hundreds of them floating around, and they were quite racist. Well, there's a guy by the name of Bernasconi who's written a big, or done some research and attacks racism. But inside his articles and stuff, there's some interesting information here. I'm going to take it out of context a little bit. Bernasconi moves from the 17th century up through the UNESCO Declaration Against Racism in 1950. He identifies the first use of the word race, roughly as we know it, in a 1664 essay by a German naturalist. But the crux of his case is identifying the 1669 Constitution of South Carolina as the real birth of racism. That document states that a free man shall have absolute authority over his Negro slaves, unquote, irrespective of the opinion of religion of the slave. Prior to the 17th century, the distinction between servant and slave was vague. After the justification of slavery in 17th century, America's slavery is explicitly linked to race. Moreover, John Locke himself was a secretary who presided over the South Carolina 1669 Constitutional Convention in 1682. When he went back to revise it, he left the offending clause in place. Locke believed slavery could never be considered voluntary, nor that it should be transmitted heretically. But attendant to those beliefs was his feeling that should one be a slave, the master holds the right of life and death. Kant, writing for a century afterwards, is portraying as having a more complicated moral relationship to slavery. Locke invested in the legal authorized slavery, but Kant did neither. In fact, he seemed opposed to the convention in some of his writings. Nevertheless, his lectures, he argues that Africans are best suited to slavery. For Bernasconi, where Kant errs is his willingness to support the idea of permanent hereditary racial differences between peoples that can be hierarchized. Well, anyhow, there you go. Well, no matter what, there's always been slavery, and there probably always will be under different terms and in different methods employed constructing race or slavery. So you can have chattel slavery, human slavery, you can have wage slavery, you can have, there's all kinds of slaveries. So you can't, it's really almost impossible to get rid of slavery because most of slavery is built on greed. They don't make black slaves because they necessarily hate blacks. They make black slaves because they're easier than anybody else to make slaves of. And if anybody black ever challenges you on that, say, well, blacks have thrived under slavery, not only in the sugar plantations, but in the cotton plantations, and with very little uprisings taking place. Well, have we found a racist corporation here? Kansas City Real Estate Company, racist? Wow. KCTV5's report on Kansas City housing disparity is now a formal argument. Quote, a complaint filed Tuesday by the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development says the Florida-based company, hired to keep dozens of Kansas City area Fannie Mae homes in shape, is more likely to slack off in Negro American and Latino neighborhoods than in Caucasian white neighborhoods. The company under fire is Cyprex. The complaint is based on a survey of conditions in the metro in March, looking at 8 maintenance categories like cutting grass, trimming shrubs, clearing trash, and fixing vandalism. Well, you know why this? You know why this is? Because the blacks are vandalizing and shit out all these houses, and the people that are supposed to keep them up can't keep up with it. So they go over where they can fix up the white neighborhoods, and they stay fixed up. I mean, you know, it's so obvious. Quote, if found one or more problems at 37% of the foreclosed homes in predominantly white communities, in communities of color, the figure jumps to 67. Yeah, that's not racism. That's because these people are tearing up the houses. hypocrite, hypocrite. The national sport. Here's comments on this story. Anonymous said they're probably afraid to venture in the CK hood even during the daylight to fix things up. Anonymous 2 said, Caucasian white neighborhoods? Really? Where do they exist? Kind of like to move there. Let's see. Anonymous 3, prime real estate. Follow the money. Valuable land bought cheaply. Redevelopment force residents to move farther out, rather back. New society for the Novu rich and the poor will get trickle-down economics slapped in their overtaxed pockets. Separate and unequal. Ugh. Pendergast drama dressed up and cover-ups. Long hands, straw hands, and our dumb, uneducated, selfish, revenge-driven, self-proclaimed, phoretic politicals doing a narcissistic tango, be a part of the democratic process, get paid? If not, then by whom? Let's play the race card for a minute. and Trump fear against the shaded youth. Ain't that America for you and me? I love my big KC. Well, boy, I'll tell you, that guy must be a progressive. Yeah. Here's another one down here, a comment. Everyone knows primate real estate is less valuable. Here's another one. There was a time Lee Wood, I guess that's around Kansas City, actively and openly did not want Jews or Italians living in their city. That's a fact. Realtors would not show them homes if they even suspected them of either group. Let's see here. What else have we got? Oh, here's a guy that's really straight out. It's all because of the niggers. Comment. Yeah, boy, I'll tell you, the white attitudes are, they are changing. There's no doubt about that. Okay, here's another one. It's called sound business practice. Why try to keep up a shitty house in a shitty neighborhood just so it can be made shittier by the future black inhabitants and surrounding black plague? Well, this is in your out in the open web news stuff, man. Here's another comment on this situation. Those houses in predominantly minority neighborhoods have been stripped of any copper, including the AC coils, if not the whole unit. The overpass just west of 435 on Indy Avenue has been stripped of its aluminum handrails. For fuck's sake. Point is, naturally the homes in these areas are in worse shape. Anything that can be scavenged has been. Wow. They always blame the black, Negro, nigger weakness on racism. But no, it's just the opposite. The weak, dirty habits of the black culture create racism. That's the way it goes. Yeah. You can't tell me, even if they're blacks, if they had a neighborhood and they kept it really nice and everything painted and no garbage and no crime, that they'd have any problems. They'd have very few problems. So, well, isn't black crime and all this kind of stuff working in our favor? You notice how the attitudes are changing here? There's another comment. Cry me a river. The people locked in the social racist cage you speak of are perfectly comfy there. For decades, billions of dollars have been poured into programs to help the Negroes become self-sufficient in every way possible. Welfare, food stamps, Medicaid, educational grants and scholarships, community investments, after-school programs, midnight basketball, community centers, you name it. It's been tried and failed miserably because the majority of Negroes prefer to play the race card and accept handouts instead of putting forth the effort to require to change their miserable situation. If you want to really look at the actions and the personalities of blacks, watch Hardcore Pawn. It's a pawn shop in Detroit. But I'm telling you, if you want to get a bird's eye view of the way black people really are, watch Hardcore Pawn. And all of that stuff came out of Tony's Kansas City blog. Opinion, jokes, and stories from Kansas City. Is it blogger.com profile? I don't know. I don't know what all this other junk is on here. Well, if you want to contact the guy that put this together, he's Tony at TonysKansasCity.com. Well, in case you haven't read the Wall Street Journal today, yeah, the Obama gang is considering a plan to allow young people, especially young, stupid, diseased people from Honduras, to apply for entry to the U.S. as refugees without making the often dangerous trek here. an effort to stem a recent surge of illegal immigration or invasion by minors, senior Obama administration officials said Thursday. Oh, so, well, if they're not going to be coming on trains and top of trains and through the river, I mean, you know, under the plan, applications would be considered inside Honduras, and those approved could safely invade the United States. The hope is that those who aren't approved wouldn't come. U.S. immigration officials have been overwhelmed by an influx of unaccompanied Central American minors. All stupid, all dumb, all mostly diseased. Many are coming from Honduras, one of the most backward countries and crime-ridden countries in the world because of their race and culture, which in recent years has been in the grip of gang violence and has one of the world's highest homicide rates. Well, that's because that's the way they are, dumb shit. Administration officials said the idea is one of the many being considered in response to the invasion surge. It doesn't mean we're going to do it, one official said. Well, if you're not going to do it, why are you talking about it? Discussions are ongoing about the standards that would be applied for entry, a second official said, adding that the potential invaders would have to show that extraordinary circumstances exist. Well, almost anybody in the third world could show that. They're living in crime-ridden, barbaric areas of their own making, of their race and culture. But we need more stupid people in this country. We can't go on without more stupid people. They're not coming in fast enough. We've got to get them more in here. And that'll solve our problems. Since the fiscal year began in October, U.S. officials have apprehended more than 57,000 children traveling alone who have crossed the southern border. Tens of thousands more people have come in family groups. Whoa! Since the fiscal year began in October, U.S. officials... No. On Friday, President half-black Barack Obama will meet with the White House with the presidents of the three countries that are sending the vast majority of unaccompanied children to the U.S. Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. Senior administration officials said Mr. Obama would push them for help in the short run and offer U.S. assistance toward long-term regional problems. Well, those people are the problems. The whole country is the problem. The whole race of people living in those countries is the problem. The presidents in those countries are problems. Specifically, Mr. Obama will press the Central American leaders to do more to warn their citizens not to come to the U.S. and to improve the centers in their countries that process people who have been deported from the U.S., officials said. Are these people insane? I mean, and they're feeding us this gobbledygook shit, putting sugar on top of it. You couldn't sell this to an educated five-year-old. Asylum is granted to people on U.S. soil. Refugee status is conferred to individuals in their own country. Both groups must meet the same legal standard. They must show a well-founded fear of persecution due to race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. In other words, homos, transsexuals, drug addicts, diseased people. Of course, none of this is to better the United States, the culture of the United States. There's nothing in here that they're saying is to better this country. Only a fraction of the child migrants have applied for asylum in recent years. But many of those who did won their cases, of course. In the first 9 months of the fiscal year, 64.7% of the asylum applications from unaccompanied minors were approved. So 65% of them, come on in. Yeah, that's okay. Approved. Stamp. Approved. Come on in. Stamp. Approved. You're okay. You're okay. You're okay. Immigration rights advocates have been pressing the administration. Immigration rights. Immigration, what they're doing has nothing to do with immigration. And rights, I hate that word. That goddamn word, I hate it. Advocates have been pressing the administration to adopt an in-country processing system for people seeking refugee status. This is the same way, same way they're doing under Bush when they were recruiting for the soldiers in the Iraq war. They actually, you know, set up army recruiting depots in third world countries. Recruited them right out of those countries to go over there and fight, and if they didn't get their ass blown off, they become citizens of the United States when they come back. That's another kettle of worms. Well, they've been pressing the administration to adopt an in-country processing system for people seeking refugee status. Quote, we have been proposing this to the administration and Congress as part of the solution, said Lavinia Lemon, president of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Invaders, a national organization with affiliated agencies that provides services to refugees and invaders nationwide. Quote, in-country processing is part of the solution to stop this flow, which is what everybody wants. They're not going to stop the flow. No matter how much you legalize them, there's still going to be millions of non-unlegal people come in there. Oh, Christ. Oh, boys and girls, I got to quit. I'm going to have a coronary here. Yeah, that's about it for today. The insanity of it all. The horror. The horror. Well, it'll all come to a head one day, and there'll be blood in every street in the country. And it won't be just half inch deep either. 14.5. I'll be back with you tomorrow, Saturn's Day, if I don't immigrate to Honduras in the meantime. 14.5. And one of Tom's terrible Tommy's sayings that I think I'm the one who invented it. I haven't heard anybody else use it. The definition of a friend: it's a lone wolf who'll take a bullet for you. That's the definition of a friend. How many friends do you have?
I wear fake gold to make up for my little cock. Got my rag on backwards so I look just like Tupac. With my cap tilted cause I'm trying to hide the fact that I'm from Maine, but I represent the society. Got a BB gun that looks just like a Mac 10. If I shut your biatch, it might not even break the skin. I wear my jeans so low you can see my booty crack. Got chrome painted rims on my 86 Pontiac with fuzzy dice in a rigged up black. Light my curfews at 10, but I stay out till midnight sitting in my ride puffing bammies from the one hitter. Can't smoke at home cause I get caught by my babysitter. I wanna be black, but with my mustache I look Mexican. I learn how to spit rhymes from reading green eggs and ham. I talk plenty shit, so that must make me hard. I did a 2-day stretch for stealing at Walmart. I'm a wigger, so go figure. I'm just a white boy that wants to be a nigger. Don't forget the do-rag. Take me to the cannon booth. Got a little bling bling. Next week I'm getting a gold tooth. Calling up some honeys. They only give me pussy because I say I got the money. None of my hoes are over 13, cuz to these little tricks, my dick looks humongous. I live in my mama's basement and I'm almost 23. Other than that, there's nothing going for me. Never had a hard day in my life, you see. Except when I took my motherfucking GED. I ain't a gangsta, bitch. I'm just a prankster, bitch. And if you step to me, I run just like a bitch. I run just far enough to where you can't catch me. Peel out in my ride and call you a pussy. But living in the suburbs, I'm the toughest on my block. And every little hoe is riding all up on my jock. Not packing too much meat, so I stuff it with a sock. You remember the first line? Yeah, I said I had a little cock. I'm a wigger, so go figure. I'm just a white boy that wants to be a nigga. My closet's full of boo-boo, sipping on the 40s. My name is really Carl, but you can call me Shody. When you see me strutting down the street, walking with a limp, it's not because I'm hard, it's because I got my ass kicked by a bunch of real G's. They beat my ass and shank me with a knife for trying to be down and claiming ghetto life. It'll all catch up to you in the end. Someday you'll be alone and I'll be with all my friends. And we'll kick your ass. Yeah, we'll beat you down. Motherfucker, don't make me act a clown. I ain't in a gang, but I can talk the slang. I know the Ebonics handbook like it ain't no thing. So I must be real, yo. I listen to MC Hammer and I'm down with Menudo. So that's pretty much how the story goes. I'm the suburban gangster that fucks 12-year-olds. Just a skinny honky that tries to act tough, but I'm the first to back down if you call my bluff. I'm a wigger, to go figure. I'm just a white boy that wants to be a nigga. Smoking token tank weed, wear a pick in my hair, stomping in my Air Force Ones, but can't afford two pair.
Here's one I heard the other day. If you're sensitive, don't listen. Do you know what Hillary Clinton said to King Kong? No? Is it in yet? Bye-bye.